to start with, I'd like to give an embarrassingly short summary of this morning's embarrassingly wordy talk. Dogen, our great ancestor, dropped off body and mind and resolved the great matter, finished his life's work. In the foundational vehicle of Buddha Dharma, the basic practice and realization is to relinquish the view that this body and mind are me or mine. In the great vehicle, the basic practice and realization of Buddha Dharma is to relinquish the view that body and mind exist in the way that they appear. Do you follow? That's a lot for like a hot afternoon. Can you see the difference? Shall I say it again?
The difference in what?
Between these two practices and realizations. The foundational vehicle and the great vehicle. Anyone dare to repeat it back?
Repeat this.
Can anyone?
It sounded the same.
Okay, so that one. In the small vehicle,
or
the foundational vehicle. And this, by the way, this is just, you know, my current understanding this afternoon. The foundational vehicle, the early teachings of the Buddha, the basic practice and realization. So this is like a big statement. I think it's the main foundational practice and realization of the wondrous mind of Nirvana, right, is to relinquish the view that body and mind, this body and mind, are me or mine. Yeah? So there is a body in this system, there is a body and mind. Body, mind. It's just that they're not me. They're not who I really am. And they're not mine. There's not a self that is the body and mind. There's not a self that possesses the body and mind. But there is a body and mind. So it's relinquishing the view that body and mind are truly who I am. They are me. I am this body and mind. It's to relinquish that view, or that I have a body and mind. But we don't have to relinquish the view that there is a body and mind. It's my understanding in the foundational vehicle. It's a little simpler. And the result of this practice is realization. This is a practice in realization. This is the result, is liberation from bondage. To kind of get a sense of that, like, and then in the great vehicle, the Mahayana, we also have to do that. And there's more. And we might add in also unique aspect of the Mahayana is for the benefit of all beings. There's the practice and realization only for the complete benefit of all beings throughout space and time. The foundational vehicle can be done without that intention. But the Mahayana, this work is done for the benefit of all beings, for the complete liberation of all beings. There is the basic practice and realization of, again, relinquishing of you. I think in both cases, the basic practices of Buddha Dharma are about relinquishing views, and I maybe even add an unconscious view that we don't even recognize that we hold. In this case, it's relinquishing the view not only that body and mind are me and mine, but that body and mind exist in the way that they appear to exist, like this. We know how they appear. We're very familiar with how body and mind appear to function. But it's this bodhisattva vow is to relinquish the view that they actually exist in the way that they appear. It's not relinquishing that their appearance, that they, you know, of course they will still appear. Yes?
Well, made that distinction between the foundation vehicle and the Mahayana, and then you added the bodhisattva vow to save all beings. But my question is it this and also this, but how are they linked? And how does one, both of them, depend on the other?
Yeah, that's a nice question. I don't think it's a fixed relationship, but I think it's often helpful, and I think it's helpful to look at it as both. We can do both, and actually particularly to start with this foundational vehicle, which is already a huge undertaking, to truly relinquish this view that this body and mind are me or mine. I mean, we might logically understand that, but when we're pushed into a corner and body and mind are threatened or attacked or praised, when the eight winds blow on body and mind, even if we've been contemplating this view over and over, we fall very quickly back into it. I can't believe they said that to me. Me, this body and mind. They said that about my body. They said that about my mind. Might be like, I have this nice idea. I don't like your idea. They said that about my mind. It's not just a mind. It's my mind. So we, you know, I think the complete practice and realization would be even when pushed into the corners that life pushes us into, that we still don't fall back into this view that it's about me or mine. It's my essential me or mine. So that's a lot to work on, but I think we get familiar with that. It's actually, I think it's more accessible. That's why it's sometimes called the foundational vehicle. I think to me that's easier to relate to, even though this is by no means easy. This is still like incredibly challenging. That's why I say it's the realization. This is like nirvana, right? So there's many other practices. I just say this is the basic turning point of liberation, as I understand it this afternoon. And then based on that, becoming more and more familiar, maybe we don't finish that, but we'll become more and more familiar with what that means, and trying it out and so on. Then we can proceed to a more subtle and vast practice and realization. That's why it's called Maha. Maha means like really expansive and vast vehicle. And it's both more expansive and vast because it's now for the benefit of all beings, not just this little like self-improvement, self-dropping, dropping the self to improve myself, but to, you know, to realize that in order for all beings to be really free, this has to get really big. And then it's no longer it. And we've already seen that this body and mind are not me or mine. We might come to see that, but we still feel like that. But they still exist, right? I mean, there's like atoms here, aren't there? like little photons and electrons and stuff are so here. Some building blocks must make up this physical body, and the Mahayana in its various systems of Mahayana says no, you can't actually find an atom. And you know, I say they don't exist in the way that they appear. So we could say, you know, they don't truly exist. Body and mind don't truly exist in and of themselves. But they do appear. It's just that when we look at the appearance of the body, that's not the true body, right? In the great vehicle. Thus, there's all these images of, like a dream, like a fantasy, like a bubble. It's it vividly appears, and yet there's nothing actually truly there. And so it's, you can see how that's like, it's more all-encompassing, right? And one might ask, well, if you already realize freedom in this foundational vehicle, why bother with this extra subtlety? And we're not going to talk about that today because it'll take too long. But to finish the story, so this dropping off body and mind, and how about in Zen, what is the basic method of dropping off body and mind? Shikantaza. Just wholeheartedly sit and thus drop off body and mind. So, and I would say that includes these other two. The other two are sound a little bit more like working on something maybe. But we could say in truly, this would maybe be my understanding of Shikantaza is that it would include these in this imperceptible way. In just wholeheartedly sitting, the view of this body and mind as me or mine is not operating. In just wholeheartedly sitting, the view that body and mind exist in the way that they appear is not. So now we have Dogen's way-seeking mind talk. Since that stuff's kind of heavy duty, here's the story. The master's initiatory name was Dogen, the way source. His secular name was Minamoto. He was a ninth generation descendant of Emperor Murakami through the emperor's son, Prince Gochuso. He was born in 1200. At that time, a physiognomist. Oh, I was going to look that one up. You know what a physiognomist is?
I think it's like geomancy.
Yeah, I think it's like geomancy of a person, right? That's right. We don't need to look it up.
Or the bumps on the forehead.
Yeah, all that. Another translation says astrologer. So, you know, looking at signs and predicting the future. This physiognomist saw him and said, this child is a holy, sage child. He has double eye pupils. Or another translation. He has deep eye pupils and will surely become a great person. I don't know what a double eye pupil would look like exactly. The physiognomist saw something. An ancient book says, when a holy person is born, his mother will die. And this person said, when the boy is six, his mother will die. The Buddha's mother died a few days after his birth, right? Another holy person. His mother was not surprised or frightened when she heard this, but loved and respected him even more. When the master was seven, his mother died. People said, despite the discrepancy of a year, the physiognomist was correct. In the winter of his third year, he read the Chinese poet Li Chao's 100 poems at his grandmother's knee. In the fall of his sixth year, he presented a collection of ancient Chinese poems that he had copied out to his father. At the time, venerable and famous Confucian scholars said, this lad is not an ordinary person. He must be a child prodigy. When he was seven, he lost his mother, and his grief was profound. And there's all kinds of biographies about Dogen in addition to Keizan's, and they differ on lots of different stories, especially about his blood family, even who his father was. It's not so clear, actually. So some say it was this one person who died when he was two, and some say it was another person who was still alive when Dogen left home at age 13. So one story is that both his parents died when he was quite young, but at least his mother when he was seven. Seeing the incense smoke rising into the air at Takao Temple at her funeral, he awakened to the impermanence of birth and death and subsequently aroused the mind of awakening. Bodhicittapada. The mind, the aspiration for awakening was aroused. In the spring of his eighth year, he read Vasubandhu's Abhidharma Kosha, where he learned about Rupa Skanda as defined as 11 categories. Do you remember what they are? This came up this morning.
The eye
and the tongue and the body. Ear, nose, tongue, body, and object. Yeah. The five physical sense faculties and the five physical objects of the world. Now you know a teaching from the Abhidharma Kosha. Although I just said 11. 11 is a strange category called imperceptible form, avijñāptiya rūpa, that's just thrown in there because Vasubandhu is into that kind of thing. And it's completely off the topic, but just so you know for the next quiz, it's a form. It's just a kind of form, right? It's the form that's an imperceptible form that's the result of taking vows. Weird, huh? Yeah. Now, why they classify that as form, they say when you make a, like, especially like a formal vow, like an ordination ceremony, it leaves like a imperceptible physical effect that actually changes you. There's four other mental skandhas they could have put this in. So sometime we can study why this is so. It's hard to imagine reading the Abhidharma Kosha as an 8-year-old and understanding it. Maybe he just kind of like, yeah. Spent like a couple of years probably. Okay, I read it. What was it about? I have no idea. We don't know. Venerable old priest said, he's as wise as Manjushri and has a real capacity for the Mahayana. Hearing this as a youth, he treasured those words and studied very hard. He was encouraged by people's encouragement. At that time, Fujiwara Moroi was the regent and chief advisor to the emperor, an unrivaled example for court officials. He took in Dogen and made him his adopted son. He passed on secrets known only to the family and taught him important things about the country. In the spring of his 12th year, his adoptive father gave the ceremony on his attaining adulthood and tried to make him an important official of the court. They start things young in the old days in Japan, huh? This kind of coming of age ceremony, and like, you should start getting involved in the court and the official business of the country. Basically, he's some kind of politician, and his stepfather, I think this is, who's raising him and kind of grooming him to be a politician. However, Dogen secretly left the villa at Kobatayama and went alone to the foot of Mount Hiei, the great Tendai monastic complex.
He was 13.
He was 13, yeah. So, this is his way-seeking mind talk, just like we all have, right? We all have these turning points. We all have these times where the conditions come together at an apex where we have to go one way or the other. These are, I think, the moments we remember, right, in our life, the important moments. Sometimes we don't notice that they're actually an apex until long afterwards. Like I recall, graduating from college and I'm wondering what to do next with my precious human life. And I'd already done some farming and thought, I actually, this may be my calling, even though I was an art major. So I was already involved in a lot of different things, right? I don't know if I want to be a professional artist, but I like doing art. And, but this, I want to stay close to the land. I want to stay close to the natural cycles of things and know how, my food comes to me, and I think it was like this aspiration to stay close to the basics somehow, and the earth. And but before I settle onto some farm, I heard about that place, Tassajara. And went in the spring, and I remember halfway through the summer, they came to me. I just went to check it out for maybe like a few weeks or something. I didn't really have a plan, but maybe after like a couple months, it was probably Leslie, because she's always in this role. There's somebody there, right? Came and said, Would you like to stay for the whole summer? If you stay for the whole summer, you'll earn 2 practice periods. And you can have these kind of intensive practice training sessions at Green Gulch or Tassajara. You can even like put them in the back and save them. It's a good deal. And we need you to wash the dishes. So that's why we offer a good deal. And I thought, a whole summer at Tassajara. I don't know about that. That's a long, long time. In the heat of the dish room or wherever. So I feel like looking back, that was one of those turning points. And I think I maybe even lost some sleep over it. I don't know, but that's a big commitment. A whole summer. I want to keep my options open. I've just graduated from this 4-year commitment of school, and I don't know if I'm ready to commit to all the summer. But it fell in that direction, so I kind of then stayed for 19 years with a little moving to Green Gulch and related wings of the community. At the time, it didn't seem like that turning point. And maybe to Dogen at this time, it's like, I don't think I'm quite ready to do this court thing, actually. I'm too young. Or, we don't know exactly, but he actually secretly left, maybe because, just like the Buddha secretly left, because sometimes it's hard to openly leave when one has a lot of expectations on one. It's nice to do everything openly, I think. But maybe for the Buddha and for young Dogen, maybe felt like, if I have this conversation with my stepfather, this is not going to happen, actually. Maybe the Buddha thought that if I have this conversation with my wife, it's not going to happen. Because I'm right on the edge myself. This is a bold move. And I will easily be convinced to stay. So anyway, at that time, a priest named Ryokan Hogen was the director of the monastery and a teacher of both the exoteric Tendai and the esoteric Shingon doctrines on Mount Hiei. He was, coincidentally, Dogen's uncle on his mother's side. So his mother's brother was a Buddhist priest, and his mother was also very devoted to Buddhism. So in a way, maybe these conditions make things easier too. It's a Buddhist culture, since about later Kazan says Dharma came to Japan in the year 500, I think. Yeah, 552, 553, 750 years of Buddha Dharma in Japan, but no Zen. And so he went to Hogen, Dharma Eye, and asked to leave home. Hogen was very surprised. He asked, well, your coming of age ceremony is approaching, and your father and foster father will be upset. What about that? And Dogen said, when my loving mother was dying, she told me to leave home and study the way. How many of us does this happen to in America? Maybe in some form or another. Yeah. Maybe we have particularly spiritual parents. They might be just don't say leave home and follow the way, but they say I hope you live a good, upright life and benefit society. We might have mothers like that. But even that, I think, is maybe quite rare in this age of decline. So, if you're a mother, you have your great causal power, possibly, over your children. My mother did say this. She actually wanted me to be ordained, leave home, and study the way. And I think the same. I don't want to futilely mix with the secular world. I just want to leave home so I can repay the debt I owe to my loving mother, grandmother, maternal aunt, and others. Hogan wept in admiration and allowed him to enter become a student. The term is nishitsu, to enter the room. It means like he's invited to come to the Dokusan room, allowing him to study at the Senko house of the Shirangama temple in Prajna Valley in Yokawa on Mount Hiei. Mount Hiei is like kind of like a town. It's a monastic complex, but like there's all these separate monasteries on the top of this giant mountain, and they kind of are part of the same institution, but they function separately. They're separate. It's an amazing place to visit in the big old forest, old growth forest. On the ninth day of the fourth month, the day after Buddha's birthday, in 1213, when he was 13, he made his bows to the chief priest Koen, the bishop, and had his head shaved. The next day, he received the Bodhisattva precepts on the precept platform at Enryakuji Temple and became a monk. That's still Mount Hiei in Kyoto, is still Enryakuji. It's the head temple complex of Tendai. You'll know Tendai, the Tendai school from China, which is this eclectic Buddhist Mahayana mix of Lotus Sutra, Nagarjuna's Middle Way, and Zen, actually, before it was a separate school, and the esoteric mantra yana practices. It's like all this is, you know, complex. But people loved it. It was the most popular, dominant Buddhist institution in Japan for hundreds of years. Later, he studied the Tendai system of Shamatha and Vipassana. That's another like kind of highlight of Juri, the founder. We've had some sesshins, maybe on some of Juri's teachings here. Shamatha and Vipassana meditation. He also studied the esoteric teachings of South India, like we might call them the Vajrayana of Japan. By the age of 17, he had read the entire Buddhist canon once. Only once. Koen was the director of the monks at Miyi Monastery and was Dogen's maternal uncle. He was unrivaled at the time in both the esoteric and exoteric teachings, so Dogen questioned him about the great matter of the Tendai tradition. In one of the biographies, the great matter of the Tendai tradition could be put as the reason why the Buddhas of the three times practice even though they're already enlightened. This is like Dogen's big koan, as you may have heard, right? He questioned him about this issue. And the director, Koen, told him, "What you now doubt is the ultimate matter of our school. This is like a really important issue, actually. It's something that's been passed down orally through the generations since Dengyo Daishi, who is Saicho, the Japanese founder of Tendai, and Shikaku, another co-founder. I cannot remove your doubt. I heard long ago that the Indian great master Bodhidharma came to China and transmitted the Buddha seal. His teaching has spread everywhere in China and is called the Zen, the Chan school. If you want to resolve this problem, you should go ask Eisai, the director of monks at Kaninji, across town in Kyoto. Investigate the ancient reality and go far away to China and look into the truth. So in the fall of his 17th year, on the 25th day of the eighth month in 1217, he joined priest Myozen's community at Kenin Monastery and took on the life of a Rinzai Zen monk. When Eisai was alive, it looks like there's some debate about this in history, but Eisai, who is considered the founder of Rinzai Zen in Japan, died like the year after Dogen first visited Kaninji. So there's some question about whether they met or not. Some say they did and they had conversations. Some say they didn't. He was like on his deathbed. But his disciple Myozen is who Dogen practiced with. When Eisai was alive, he had all who came to Kaninji practice Zen wait for 3 years before they were permitted to wear Zen priest robes. However, when Dogen came, he was allowed to wear them in September. He sort of bypassed the usual standards. He was already had been a monk for 4 years in this other school. So we don't know what was going on. It seems like there's these different schools and like Eisai, well, this is a Zen thing now. You gotta like make it clear what you're doing here, and you almost like you're converting, you're changing schools here, so this is a serious matter. In December, he was given the 9-panel Sangati Bokesa robe and was considered fit to practice. Priest Myozen, Eisai's legitimate Dharma heir, transmitted the 3 traditions of exoteric, esoteric, and mind. So this was, and this appears through this, again, that Eisai brought the Zen lineage, but he was still involved in the other Tendai practices, and so in a way, as Keizan later says, Eisai's Zen was not really like a, kind of a pure Zen. It mixed in, they're called Ken, means like the revealed outer teachings, exoteric, which refers to the Tendai, Lotus Sutra and so on. The Mitsu, if you were here a couple of days ago, intimate or secret inner teachings, which it refers to the mantra school, the Shingon school, and the mind school, which refers to Zen. So Ken, Mitsu, and Shin are the kind of abbreviated versions. It's interesting that Zen is called the mind school. Note that it's not actually called the body school. But it could be.
Because it's the same.
Yeah. In the records of Kaninji's priest Eisai, it says, only Myozen is entrusted with the Dharma treasury of Eisai. Therefore, those who want to ask about Eisai's Dharma must ask Myozen. Dogen entered Myozen's quarters and received the Bodhisattva precepts a second time, like in a new tradition. Still the same precepts. And still, this is done, right? Like, it's common in Japan, if you've already received the Bodhisattva precepts and you go to a new temple to stay for a while with a new teacher, you can receive them again. Like when I went as a priest to Bukokuji and received the Bodhisattva precepts again with the lineage document of that teacher to make a connection with that lineage. But same bodhisattva precepts. He was given a robe and bowl and so on. The 134 deity practices, probably some Shingon thing, instructions on the Goma ritual and so on of the Tanyu Ryu sect. Goma, you know what the Goma? Or in Sanskrit, Homa, is the fire rituals, which is a Shingai and Shingon and Tendai practice based on these like Brahmin, Indian Brahmin rituals that go way, way back, way before Buddha's time, thousands of years before Christ in India. And I find it interesting myself. This is what one of the things that Shoho is studying in Nepal right now is this kind of like other Indian Buddhist schools that were influenced and were influenced by Buddhism. It's very amazing to see that the practitioners in old India and how they conversed with each other and influenced each other. So this fire ritual is like making like sacrificial offerings to the gods, pouring various substances into the fire, like making offerings but into the fire. Like Agni is the fire god in his, you know, the old Vedas. And so still they do this in Japan. Or is it some kind of fire ceremony? They often have a huge fire inside these big old wooden temples. The flames like look like they're getting close to the old wooden roof, but they do it anyway. And even at Pema Osalung down the road here, I've seen the Tibetan style of these fire ceremonies, very elaborate, all the different types of things. It's like a half day event of this ritual of offering, making offerings, in this case, to the Buddhist Sambhogakaya beings. And Dogen studied the Vinaya precepts, the complex monastic code, and again studied Shamatha and Vipassana. And he heard about Rinzai Zen for the first time and received the correct lineage of the three traditions of exoteric, esoteric, and mind. He was Myo Zen's sole legitimate heir. So all this is just to say that it's interesting that Dogen had a very eclectic background, right? And before he got into Zen, he studied a lot of other Buddha Dharma. 7 years passed. In the spring of his 23rd year, on the 22nd day of the second month, in 1223, he paid his respects at the founder's stupa at Keninji and accompanied Myo Zen to China. And they arrived at Mount Tian Tong in 1223. Lots happens when Dogen arrives in China that Keizan does not record, but is in the more extensive biographies. And I think that Kathy may tell some of these stories this fall.
The first things that happened was he ran into the old Tenzo.
Yep. He ran into the Tenzo and had various conversations with maybe even more than one Tenzo, yeah?
Yeah. That
reminded the Tenzo to head for the kitchen. Because if she doesn't do it, who will? So, maybe after the Tenzos, one of the first of these other teachers that Dogen saw was Zhu Yan of Mount Qing. Zhu Yan asked, "When did you arrive here?" These loaded Zen questions. Dogen's like, "Oh, better be on my toes." "In April of last year," Dogen said. Zhu Yan said, "Did you come just mimicking others?" Kind of interesting. "Or did you come following a group?" is another translation. And I don't know, it's no explanation here, but I can imagine maybe it was there were these, since the time of Saicho and in the 800s or maybe even earlier, there were always practitioners coming from Japan to visit the great practice places of China, and it was like it was like the thing, right? Oh, let's go to China to check out the practice there because that's where it's really happening. And maybe the Chinese had a little bit like, here comes another one of those Japanese priests. If somebody said that's cool to go to China. So are you just coming following all those people that say like you should go to China? Are you just coming mimicking others? So then they go home and they say, Dogen says like the signs his like name at the bottom of his essay sometimes, Dogen the monk who transmitted Dharma from China. So there, this is I think an important thing for people. And maybe this teacher's kind of testing, what's this really about here? Why did you really come? Actually, did you come just mimicking others? Dogen said, "What about when I don't come just mimicking others?" And Zhu Yan said, "That is still coming mimicking others." What's going on there? Maybe it's kind of like that. Now the kind of mimicking that we're talking about is a kind of Zen style mimicking, right? Like, what about when I don't come mimicking others? Kind of a classic, if when you read these Zen stories, it's kind of a classic response, you know, very good Dogen. It fits so nicely into this record of Zen stories. Maybe that's what Zhu Yan said. Well, that answer actually is still mimicking others. And then Dogen kind of, I think very nicely, without missing a beat, says, "Well, since I did come mimicking others, what's the problem with that? Or why is this not correct?" Nice question, I think. Nice kind of comeback. Okay, you're right. I'm just following along with the customs or something. So, here I am. Various causes and conditions brought you here. Various causes and conditions brought me here. I would say some of these causes and conditions are contrived mimics and some of them are authentic. I don't know about that. Just looks like a bunch of causes and conditions inescapably bringing us to the moment. Since I did come mimicking others, why is this not correct? Zhu Yan, of course, struck him lightly and said, "What a talkative fellow." And Dogen, still not going to let it go at that point, he says, "It's not that I'm not a talkative fellow, but why am I not correct?" Or, "It's not that I'm not a talkative fellow, but how about this? Or is there any problem with this?" Zhu Yan said, "Why don't you sit down for a while and have some tea?" And he just said something about young Dogen's kind of on the ball kind of attitude. He's ready to kind of do some Dharma sparring with anyone. It might be intimidating to go to great Song Dynasty China and play around with the old worthies like that.
He's probably speaking Chinese.
Yeah, that's a question, actually. That because one of these other biographies says he never really learned Chinese, so he had to communicate in writing because the writing is the same. The Chinese characters are the same in Japanese, but the sound is completely different. So some say that his conversations with his teacher, Tendo Nyojo, were like written, like note passing, which is convenient for them having a journal later, which was published as the Hokyoki. But I don't know if every conversation, in the movie version, I know some of you have seen the movie, it's in Japanese, but I think that, as I recall, during Dogen's time in China, at least the Chinese teachers are speaking in Chinese, and then the movie is made for the Japanese and has subtitles for the Japanese viewers in the movie, kind of implying that they're trying to make the movie authentic, like actually they spoke Chinese and the Japanese viewers are not going to get it.
What's the movie called?
I think it's called Zen. It's a great movie. I enjoyed it. It's, you know, it's a little bit like, you know, a more embellished biography. But, you know, it portrayed the character of Dogen like that director's vision of Dogen. And but it's interesting to see Dogen on the screen. He's a very straightforward character in the film. Maybe we can do we have done a viewing here before. Maybe we can do another if people want. He also went to visit Master Tzu Cho and asked, "What is Buddha?" Tzu Cho replied, "The one in the Buddha hall, on the shrine." And Dogen said, "Well, if he's in the temple building there, how can he be everywhere pervading the universe?" And Tzu Cho said, "He is everywhere pervading the universe." And Dogen said, "Blunder," is one translation or another, is fallen in words. These little koan-like anecdotes with Dogen. What was his problem with that? Maybe he felt like it was too easy. Again, what is Buddha? The one on the altar. And Dogen says, "Well, if he's there in the altar, how can he pervade the whole universe?" And Tsuchiya said, he does pervade the whole universe. Maybe Dogen felt like, no. We need something more than that. Going around and engaging various masters in dialogue like this, he became very conceited and proud, thinking, "No one in China or Japan is my equal, young whippersnapper." As he was about to return to Japan, "There's no Zen in China, I'm going home," a man named Lao Xin encouraged him to stay. He said, maybe this was skillful means. Maybe he had a conversation with Dogen who said, "There's no Zen in China." And maybe that's the reason that this person said, "Actually, there's only one person in China who knows the way. Old Master Ru Jing." Maybe if he said, "Come off it, young lad. There's Zen all over the place. Why don't you come off your arrogant trip?" But maybe he's like, "That won't work." I would say, "There's this one you haven't met yet, the real one. If you meet him, you'll have a chance to get it." Thus instructed, it was still more than a year before he visited Ru Jing. We don't know why, what he was doing in the meantime. At the time, Wu Qi, Liao Pai had died, and Master Ru Jing of Qingsi, another monastery, then became the next abbot at Mount Tiantong. thinking they can. So I think Dogen had gone to Tian, my recollection, he went to Tiantong when he first got to China. It was this other abbot, and he kind of checked him out, and it's like, well, there's not much here. He left, and then later, Ru Jing became the abbot, and he then went back. And since the conditions were right, Dogen went to see him and inquire about his doubt. At the first meeting, he was humbled, and consequently they became master and disciple. And apparently, literally, this word for being humbled in Japanese is his spearhead was broken. Nice image for being humbled, right? Dogen's got this sharp spearhead where he's kind of poking everybody. Ru Jing kind of like broke off the sharp tip of his spear. Intending to practice fully, Dogen wrote a letter that said, "Since my youth, I have aroused bodhicitta, bodai shin. Though I sought the way from various masters in my own country and knew a little about the principle of cause and effect, I still did not know the real goal of Buddha Dharma, or the real like key here is like refuge." Interestingly, that Dogen at the end of his life wrote an essay called Deep Faith in Cause and Effect, which he took to be like a very important issue. But in his, you know, before he's, when he's just getting started practicing Zen here, he's like, I did learn some about cause and effect. I kind of see how things work in this dependently co-arising world of cause and effect. But I still haven't gotten to the bottom of this ultimate refuge of Buddha Dharma. I was occupied with its names and signs. Finally, I entered the room of Eisai and learned about Rinzai teachings for the first time. Now I have followed Dharma teacher Myozen to China and have been able to come here where you teach. It is a good fortune or great blessings resulting from conditions in past lives. I, an insignificant person from a distant land, ask you in your great compassion to allow me to come often to your quarters to respectfully ask about the essentials of the Dharma, regardless of whether it's day or night or how I am dressed. meaning in my formal robes for Dokusan, or can I just come kind of informally and hang out with you? The Japanese is, I'd like to come, be able to come either yuigi or not yuigi. Dogen has this essay called Gyobutsu Yuigi, which is like the dignified conduct of practicing Buddhas. So I'd like to be able to come in the dignified conduct of formal Dokusan and not in that way. And day and night, maybe kind of a big request for Ru Jing that would maybe like to get some sleep at night. But as we hear in other places, he actually didn't sleep very much. Just a couple hours. But it's this great bodhicitta resolve, right, of Dogen to be asking this pretty like forward sounding letter. Ru Jing said, "Disciple Dogen, regardless of whether it's day or night, or informal or formal, in your great kindness and great compassion, please hear my request and grant it." And then Ru Jing said, "Disciple Dogen, from now on, regardless of whether you're wearing your okesa or not, or whether it's day or night, you may question me. I will overlook the absence of formal ceremony as if we were father and son." So they form this intimate relationship early on. Regarding Dogen's major question, where remember when he first went to to this Tendai teacher and asked about if everyone is perfectly enlightened from the start, why do we need to practice? And Tendai teacher said, this is so profound that like you better go to the Zen teacher, even though this is the issue of our school too. It's kind of funny he would say this, right? So this is a wonderful, actually it's a reprint of a longer biography of Dogen by Hee-jin Kim that Shohaku Okamura greatly appreciated, so he put in the appendix of Realizing Gendo Koan here. And it's got a lot of, kind of straight out of this Hee-jin Kim book, but then with Shohaku's footnotes about the latest scholarship on the history of Dogen. So I find this kind of thing kind of interesting, but you maybe have to be kind of like a Dogen freak to be into a lot of these details. But this is about this Tendai doctrine of original enlightenment, Hongaku, meaning like everyone is originally awake from the start. Everyone is, and this is, you know, Buddha nature. It's based on Buddha nature, Tathagata Garba teachings. Everyone is fully endowed with Buddha nature from the start, which all Mahayana teachings would agree with. But this Tendai school mixed with this kind of Vajrayana aspect took it kind of like, of course, we want to keep taking it further and further into non-duality as far as it will go. So if you have faith in this original enlightenment, there's no need to do anything. Everything is completely perfect from the start. And in addition to this doctrine of original enlightenment was a related teaching of this body itself is Buddha. Sokushin Jobutsu. Shin, in this case, being body, which is actually the Shingon teaching of Kukai, the founder, which was likewise radicalized by Japanese Buddhism. This tenet accepted the immediate enlightenment of the psychophysical existence, the five skandhas, with all its particularities, which were not, as Zen Buddhists would say, a finger pointing to the moon, but the moon itself, or to put it differently, not the accommodative manifestations of the Dharmakaya, but the Dharmakaya itself. So in other words, this body and mind, which we've been talking about, right? This body and mind itself, as it is the Dharmakaya. It's not just even a manifestation as a transformation manifestation body. It is the Dharmakaya. You can see how, you know, once you get into these kind of teachings, maybe and the schools are sort of trying to outdo each other. I can say something even more radical than that. This is how far it got. The inconceivable Dharmakaya is this body and mind. This doctrine of esoteric Buddhism, both Shingon and Tendai versions, influenced the ethos of the time. Mundane existence was sanctified, as it was by the doctrine of original enlightenment. Which is, we hear a lot of things similar to this in Zen, right? We love it, don't we? Because then everything is practice, you know? So the doctrines of original enlightenment and this body itself is Buddha went hand in hand in reinforcing the efficacy of faith, the absolutization of phenomena, in other words, that phenomena just as they are the ultimate, and the instantaneous attainment of liberation, we might even say like the natural, already fully complete attainment of realization. When one denied any metaphysical hiatus between principle and phenomena, however, meaning like you could say this is the two truths, the conventional and the ultimate, if you say there was no difference between them at all, this is, you know, this is a lot of fine lines in here, right? Because the two truths are not separate. Nagarjuna says, and yet, they can't be separated, and yet there are two truths. They can be spoken of in these two ways, form and emptiness. Form itself is emptiness, and yet we have to be careful when we start getting into this territory, right? When one denied any possible difference between the ultimate and the conventional, however, even the most profound Mahayana teachings became dangerously indistinguishable from a crude and irresponsible acceptance of whatever existed in the world at the sacrifice of spiritual exertion and practice. Interesting, huh? Because I think this very same thing, I think, it still goes on in our little barbarian country, far from the from the Buddha's time and place, right? Not the non-dual spiritual teachings of America are like widespread in many forms, and they're incredibly liberating, I would say, and they're dangerous in this way, because it's dangerously close to a crude and irresponsible acceptance of whatever exists in the world as it is at the sacrifice of wholehearted effort and practice. In fact, a number of dangerous misinterpretations of these teachings were rampant toward the close of the Heian period and were especially flagrant among worldly-minded Buddhist monks who attempted to rationalize the pursuit of their selfish interests. And it says elsewhere, this was this time, or by Dogen's time, it's not just in the movie, but there really were these like kind of warrior monks, apparently, lots of them, that carried weapons and kind of were totally involved in politics, government politics, and would fight each other and fight different factions that had different political views. Is, you know, these were like ordained monks, right? Things had become like totally corrupt, and some people say based on these teachings of non-duality. Because all that's okay, right? It's all it's not even a manifestation. My, like, you know, sword is the Dharmakaya. Furthermore, an exclusive claim of faith, which required no strenuous spiritual exertion, became readily associated with the antinomian cynicism inspired by the age of decline. In other words, that also, these teachings of this is the age of decline, even though it's the Dharmakaya, it's also the age of decline. And and faith, I think, is interesting, because when you get into this kind of realm of non-duality, where there's no practice anymore, then what do you do, right? Well, you just have to have complete faith that that's so. Any practice is kind of like just messing around off track. But if you have total faith in this teaching, you don't even need to know why. Or if you do some kind of like logical reasoning, maybe that's already getting too involved. Just believe it. So again, I think things very similar to this are actually part of Soto Zen. Dogen will say, to practice Shikan Taza, you first have to start with this strong faith that you are perfect from the start. Dogen says this in Gakudo Yojinshu. For practice of Shikan Taza, first we need a strong grounding in faith or trust in our inherent Buddha nature. You could say the twist, though, is that then Dogen says, based on that faith, now just wholeheartedly sit. Maybe these people just have faith, and to wholeheartedly sit would be kind of like extra. It's worth noting that this moral, intellectual, and religious crisis coincided with the popularity of the doctrines of original enlightenment and this body itself is Buddha. The latter unwittingly served to rationalize the apathetic state of affairs. The significance of Dogen's original question on Mount Hiei and his endeavors thereafter can only be properly understood in light of his acute sense of this crisis of the age in which he lived. Yeah, this gives more context for Dogen's burning question. If we are primordially enlightened and consequently liberated here and now within this body-mind existence, then why do we have to exert ourselves at all? What is the significance of moral practice, intellectual practice, ceremonial practice, meditative practice, religious practice? Dogen did not question the truth of original enlightenment, but believed it with his whole heart and mind. So he was down with this, right? This must be so. However, he did question the significance of the activities that constituted human existence, which amounted to asking, what is the meaning of existence? And thus, his way-seeking mind was fueled by this question. And seeing the results, right? Seeing the... it's not just a theoretical issue for Dogen. Saying, I hear all these teachers are saying this, and I'm like watching how they're living. And then they're saying, well, it's all it, right? We talked about this the other day, I think, right? Like, for me, my one of my personal lifelong koans, maybe it is a little bit similar to Dogen's, in that it's, does the awakened, the truly awakened life look any particular way? That's my koan. Which is, I guess, kind of like, does it mean there's some practice? It's a little different than maybe Dogen's is more about like if we're already fully awakened, why do we have to practice in order to like kind of the practice that would usually lead to awakening? Doesn't really make sense for Dogen. For me, that's it, I think also an interesting question, but for me even more interesting is kind of like after awakening, if one is truly fully awake, does that necessarily mean that one's life will appear in a certain way? Like what one does, kind of like not so much what leads to the realization, but maybe before I fully sign up for the realization. Does that mean I'm going to have to completely change? Sometimes kind of like maybe more in the foundational vehicle teachings that are less emphasizing non-duality, there are teachings in the sutras that almost imply at certain stages of realization you can no longer kind of like live in the work, you can't engage in the workings of conventional society anymore. The Buddha says various places, because they're all basically based on delusion, or many of them are. So maybe there's certain things you could do that aren't based on like name and gain and pleasure and security and comfort and these things. But That's the question, right? And the non-dual traditions are more willing to say, actually, especially as skillful means, anything can manifest in order to help people, in order to benefit others, in order to draw people in, not because into the Dharma, not because for my own sake. So it remains a koan. It probably will for a while. Yes.
With the, I don't know much about Hinayana traditions, but sort of there's a couple of teachers. I know of the Buddha. I've read a bit about Ajahn Chah, and how they manifest their lives is almost as if it, like in practice, they spend their lives teaching people, relieving suffering. It's in practice, it pretty much looks like they're saving all beings, even though they might have a sign on the dotted line, but that sort of thing. I'm just wondering, does it make much difference if you are, for want of a better term, an accomplished practitioner? Is that distinction between saving all beings and not, does it really matter? Because just based on their examples, they seem to be acting as if they are.
No, I agree. Yeah, it does seem like they are. I think that's right. That's how I would understand it. Yeah, that's, we see the example in the Buddha and Ajahn Chah. Seems like in this very direct way, that's their life, right? They're just responding. And when they're not, they're just sitting zazen. At least the Buddha is like, he was just available to talk with people. And when nobody came, he just sat. He wasn't doing anything else. And maybe Ajahn Chah also, right? I don't think he had many other activities at Wat Pabong. But so I think that seems pretty clear. But then the question is, could it look other ways than that? Right? Could it appear, could a completely awakened life appear in other ways? And we have like Vimalakirti Sutra. What?
Satya in Portland.
Yeah, as I told the story for the other day, who I feel like is his bodhicitta is like exploded open just from my knowing him as a friend. And his life is this radical, radical non-doing, except just practicing. And like for those who went there, his friend of mine, his teeth are falling out, rotting and falling out because he doesn't bother. He doesn't have any money to or anything to go to the dentist, and he doesn't want to do anything except just be in accord with the environment and the people around him and engage around the heart of liberation. And so again, I think there's this, but then it's scary, right? If we really start limiting it to that. If we really say that's what it must look like, I think we don't want to hear that, right? This is the question. And, of course, so I'm talking about like completely free from self-clinging. Along the way, I think it's quite obvious, there's many ways to practice along the path. But if the goal, I could say, is this complete freedom for the benefit of all beings, I mean, traditionally, bodhicitta is like, is to not go halfway, right? To become a Buddha, manifest Buddhahood for the benefit of all beings, moment to moment, without wavering or regressing. Then, for me, it's an important thing to clarify because, again, I might not want a sign on the dotted line because I like various worldly activities. I really like them. Yes.
Do you think that you would necessarily recognize such a one? And if so, what?
Yeah, sometimes I've wondered about that. Again, with the skillful means issue thrown in there, that throws a wrench in it, because you could say, We should be able to recognize it because we can kind of see what appears to be self-centeredness in people, right? And so if there's no such thing as skillful means, then I think you maybe can, right? Like, that looks kind of self-centered. But if it's skillful means, that person is appearing to look self-centered for my sake, then...
I don't actually even buy that, because what looks self-centered to Patrice might not look self-centered to me in an activity of a person.
Yeah. There's some things, maybe there's some things that are a gray area, right?
Yeah, I think there's a lot. I mean, there's some that may be radical things that...
Yeah. Well, well, yeah, I think that's a great point. That helps. That's a turning word you offered for my koan. And I think of my teacher Tenshin Roshi with, you know, he would like to push this kind of thing sometimes. And I would like to question him sometimes because we're engaged and like, let's really look at this. So people living at Green Gulch in priest training with him would be like, it's my day off today on Sunday. I'd really like to go into town and buy a newspaper to read. Part of his priest training thing is like, if you're going to do anything, check with me and for a while. And I'd like to do this. And he'd say like, do you think that would be beneficial to all beings? I mean, maybe it's just to see if we get caught by that. Yes, I do think it would be. And we leave it at that. Well, how so? Sit down for a cup of tea a minute. How would that be? To burn these petroleum products, to read about the woes of the world. Unless, like, maybe you had a dream last night that at Tam Junction you will meet your disciple on the street corner at this particular time at the newspaper stand. And after you then make this Dharma connection that will come to fruition 16 years from now, according to destiny, then when you open page 32 of the Chronicle, you will see an article that will change your life, because you will respond to this article and save at least one being, which you wouldn't have if you didn't. But, you know, that wasn't my intention to go get the newspaper. Yes.
It's interesting that your one calling is so interesting to me and others. But you know, there's of course no connection between brown robe and enlightenment at all. But you know, there at SCBA, you know, we're just so many different ways of Dharma. And you'd think that there'd be kind of at least trending towards convergence there. It was just so refreshingly varied. I mean, you know, there's Grace Shearson, the only PhD psychologist in Madera County. And Judith Regeer, who, you know, was on the phone with her husband talking about their troubled teenager. Just so many other examples of people saving all beings in such a varied way.
So yeah, again, I think this is beautiful to see the variety of practice going on in a new land where it's growing and spreading in many ways, and beautiful, and due to whatever causes and conditions, this particular personality can get into this kind of like high standard kind of Like you say, the brown robe doesn't necessarily mean enlightenment, right? So there's just a bunch of people trying to find their way. And but for me, what's more interesting, and may not be to many others, but like, what about complete, perfect awakening, Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi? What about that? And that's what, you know, grabs me. That's what I think, that's what fuels my bodhicitta, actually. That's what, I don't think I would have lasted this long in this practice without some kind of fire around this possibility that, and again, is this a delusion coming from the old sutras? Maybe there's no such thing, really. I'm a kind of idealistic person. I know my personality type is very idealistic. So I love the most ideal stories. A lot of people don't, actually. Some people hate it. Like, that's not for me, those stories about the Buddha's intense practice. Like, I'm looking to find some contentment in my everyday life without changing it too much. And that's beautiful, I think, too, because it is practice. But for me, it's like, it's not something that I chose, really. It's like something that has come to me that I can't seem to get rid of. And also because I've seen people in this life who seem unusual and are doing something different enough, or their lives are manifesting different enough to me that challenge my assumptions. Is that just their karma? That's a nice answer that has somehow sometimes put the rhinoceros of doubt to rest for me for a few months at a time, maybe. It's just everyone's individual karma. It's not like that's more enlightened lifestyle than that. That one's worked temporarily for me, but not definitively. Yes?
So, then how do you reconcile that sort of aspiration with non-attainment?
Attainment of, like, the way? Or attainment of, there's no thing to attain, right? There's no thing to attain.
Yeah.
No, like, kind of like state.
You have aspirations and, you know, you're talking about some sort of an idealistic. I mean, I've seen those people too.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the Heart Sutra says no attainment, right? And some other translations of it say no attainment and no non-attainment. It says no attainment, but it also says no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue. So maybe we'd like to pick up on that particular point and say that's the part I resonate with most in the Heart Sutra, is no attainment. In fact, I've even seen this calligraphic, beautiful English calligraphy version of the Heart Sutra by some like old Zen center calligrapher in the 70s or something. Maybe you've seen it, these floating around, and it's all in black, and that one word, one line is in red, with no attainment, or with nothing to attain. And so like that calligrapher like really picked up on that line too. And Dogen also says, you know, no grasping or seeking or gaining idea, and when he's giving his meditation instructions. And yet the character like toku, and there's several characters that mean like attain or reach, are like all woven through all these texts. There's definitely teachings about reaching the way. So it's a tricky issue, I think. I think particularly if we think it's some thing or some state or final resolution, even that gets tricky. But in terms of like, there is suffering and there is the end of suffering, we can make differences, right? In a way, that's this original enlightenment thing was maybe emphasizing the non-attainment thing and cause some problems if it goes too far into that side. There's nothing to attain because this is already it, and therefore my sword is already it, and therefore everything we're doing is already it because there's nothing to attain. So it's tricky. I think that these Zen teachings about no attainment are just to kind of like, I feel like they're molding, they're shaping our bodhicitta so that we don't get too kind of like future goal oriented, thing or state oriented. And yet, there's a Dharma teaching, you know, for in response to everything from each side, right? It's like if we fall too far to the one side, oh, I can really, even just within Dogen, right? With my personal koan, I can find inspired passages of Dogen that completely relieve it, kind of around the non-attainment side, and then I can find other passages of Dogen and like, ooh, I guess maybe that's not what he meant. So, which is beautiful, right? That's what keeps us going. Without falling into either extreme, the fine razor's edge of the middle way, the maddening middle way, the excruciating middle way, the gentle ride of the middle way, the unfindable middle way, the dropped off middle way, the taken up middle way. We dedicate any merit generated anywhere, at any time, to all beings. Full practice and realization of the middle way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.